This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is James Naughtie. Thank you very much for downloading this edition of Book Club from BBC Radio 4. Hello and welcome to Book Club, where we're taking a railway journey. Curiously, it's on a railway that is famous and still celebrated in the United States, but one that never had tracks or trains. Colson Whitehead's novel, The Underground Railroad, takes its title from the secret network that gave slaves from the Deep South a hazardous pathway north to freedom. Colson, who's an African-American man himself, thought as a child that it really was a railroad, and so in his novel, he's built one in his imagination, carrying the slaves in subterranean tunnels. There they face the same dangers as the original runaways did on their journeys north. Cora is the woman who's at the heart of this story, making the dangerous, circuitous journey and hoping to be reunited with her mother Mabel, who she thinks has reached Canada. There are many obstacles. The slave catcher, Ridgway, for example, who makes his living by trying to capture the people on the run from the plantations and delivering them for punishment, often of a very harsh kind. And in this powerful emotional narrative, Colson explores the roots of attitudes in 19th century America that stretched to breaking point, the ambiguity of the freedoms guaranteed in the Declaration of Independence itself, and have proved such a persistent social force, even in contemporary American society. Colson Whitehead, welcome to Book Club.
How do you do? Thanks for having me.
I wonder what you knew as a child about these matters. You were told about the Underground Railroad. It obviously fascinated you. Was your awareness of these things sharp? You grew up in New York. You had a reasonably comfortable background in a professional family. Did it touch you a great deal, even as a child, the story of what happened in the South?
You know, slavery is not taught extensively or deeply at all. You know, I think people would rather not think about it. I feel like in third grade, we have 10 minutes on slavery and then 40 minutes on Abraham Lincoln. Everything's fixed. And about 10 minutes on segregation and Jim Crow laws, and then 40 minutes on Martin Luther King. Everything is fixed. And so it's gotten a bit better now, I think. Now we do like 15 minutes on slavery and 35 on Abraham Lincoln. But of course, there's never been a true reckoning with that part of our history.
And you really imagined these trains rolling north, did you?
Well, yeah, those words are so evocative. Underground Railroad, you think it's a literal train. And then your teacher hopefully explains quickly what it actually was. But some people get through their whole lives thinking it's a real train. And some folks have actually read my book and think, you really drew a well-drawn picture of these underground trains. I'm like, it didn't happen. It's imaginary, I thank you. But that's not how it actually worked.
How did you come to decide on the metaphor?
I was really just staring off into space one afternoon, as I often do, in a depressive stupor in my apartment, and came across a reference to the railroad and remembered that childhood image. And I thought, wouldn't it be weird just to make a novel out of it? And that's more of a premise, not so much of a story. So I added the element that each state that our protagonist goes through is a different state of American possibility, like Gulliver's Travels. You know, it's Gulliver's Travels, it's the Odyssey, it's Pilgrim's Progress. That classic structure where a hero or heroine is tested on a series of allegorical adventures before he or she can go on to the next chapter, next adventure. It seemed a great structure for talking about different aspects of American history.
Well, let's get the first question from our readers here in Brookhusting House.
I found the story of Cora and her people to be a profoundly powerful and emotionally haunting one. Where did the character of Cora come from?
You know, sometimes I take characters and supporting characters from people I know or myself, fragments or facets of people I know. In this case, Cora, of all my characters, has the least amount of me in her, which is probably why it's my most popular book. I've sort of decided, I'm not really sure where she came from. I had an idea of someone who could stand up to the series of tasks I was setting before her. It takes a lot of courage and imagination to conceive of a place of freedom in the North when you've only seen the plantation that you've been abused and tortured on. So I knew she'd be a formidable character, and she really came into focus in two moments early on in the book. One where she defends her garden from a bully who wants to take it from her, and then second when she protects a young boy from being beaten. And once I had those two moments, I had a sort of template for her personality. She doesn't take the easy way out. She stands up for herself and doesn't do what's expected.
On the Randall plantation, Cora has a small plot of land that she inherits from her grandmother and then her mother. And she loses it, fights for it, gets it back. But I thought it was such an interesting concept of ownership, that a slave could have the privilege of ownership. What was your intent of creating this small plot of land for Cora?
It's a teeny tiny plot of land, and it's there to show inheritance, this thing passed down by generations, show how small it is, and to give her something to hold on to and something to fight for. And so it serves a few different functions in the story.
And we see the journey laid out in a historical context, because the book begins with her grandmother. Her mother goes away. She believes that she's found freedom, although she can't know that. So we do see the story of a family, and then we see a journey.
It's generational bondage.
Yeah.
Yeah, so on that note of the generational relationship, there's obviously a very strong focus on women throughout the book, and through Cora, Mabel and Adjaye, through their lives, we're able to explore racialized and gendered violence, from the rape of these women to the forced sterilization program in South Carolina. And I just wondered, did you kind of set out thinking, I want to write a book that addresses these histories that are so often ignored, or did it kind of come along the way?
Yeah, I mean, I knew I was going to bring in eugenics and forced sterilization years before I actually wrote the book. I had the book in the back of my head for a long time. And by having the book reset every 60 pages as she goes to a different state, I could, you know, really have this a bigger discussion about different moments in American history, Black history, forced sterilization, medical experimentation. I knew that was going to be in there for a long time. Before I start writing, I'm a big planner. And so who's my protagonist? What's the voice of the book? The choice to have a female protagonist came about for a few reasons. There's a famous slave narrative written by Harriet Jacobs, and she writes very movingly about the dilemma of the female slave. When a slave girl becomes a slave woman, you enter a new, more terrible form of slavery. You're now subject to your master's sexual desires, if you weren't already. You're supposed to pump out babies, because babies are money, are property, more slaves for your master. And so it's a different predicament than face the male slave, not worse or just different. And it seemed worthy of taking up in the book. And then once you make that choice, you have to follow through. So most likely she has been abused in some way. And then that determines her psychology, the freedom she can imagine for herself, her hopes and dreams. Can she get close to Caesar, Royal, these different people who help her?
I think it's a point at which we might benefit from a reading from the book, for those who haven't read it, to get the flavor. Give us a passage and tell us, Coulson, if you will, where it comes in the story. Just set the scene.
Sure. It's early in the book. We're on Georgia, where Cora's home plantation is located. And it's old Jockey's birthday. He's the oldest slave in the plantation. And whenever he senses a need for release in the slave quarter, he'll declare, "It's my birthday." It could be once a year, twice a year. It's never the same day. But they have a little feast. They have music. And it's a brief respite from the daily plantation hell. So it's old Jockey's birthday. The music stopped. The circle broke. The Randall brothers had emerged from the great house and were among them. The slaves stepped aside, making calculations of what distance represented the right proportion of fear and respect. "Master James," Jockey said. His good hand gripped the arm of his chair as if to rise. "Master Terence." "Don't let us disturb you," Terence said. "My brother and I were discussing business and heard the music. I told him, 'Now that is the most god-awful racket I've ever heard.'" The Randalls were drinking wine out of goblets of cut glass and looked as if they'd drained a few bottles. Cora searched for Caesar's face in the crowd. She didn't find him. He hadn't been present the last time the brothers appeared together on the northern half. You did well to remember the different lessons of those occasions. Something always happened when the Randalls ventured into the quarter, sooner or later. A new thing coming that you couldn't predict until it was upon you.
And you get a real sense there of the social stratification that existed in the plantation, the place that everybody had to occupy, whether they liked it or not.
The Randalls, of course, are the slave owners,
indeed,
second generation or third generation. And you can have a brief feast, you can have a brief celebration, but always up the hill is the master's house and reality waiting to intrude.
I was really interested in the way that Cora sort of navigated the forward steps and backward steps between escaping and freedom. It was like she escaped, but she didn't escape to freedom. It's like two steps forward, one step back all the time. And I just wonder, it left me questioning, oh yeah, so this wasn't freedom, really. So what kept her going? What kept her going?
Well, she's not going to go back. That's one thing. And then, you know, she has one idea of freedom, not having actually been off the plantation. And of course, it's tested when she gets to South Carolina and she sees some flaws in South Carolina's conception of freedom. She gets to North Carolina and has another view of what America is. She finds a black utopia in Indiana where there's a free black community, a farm where runaway slaves and people seeking a better life can start anew. And then that has flaws. So, you know, part of the journey is becoming a person. She starts off as an object, a slave, a piece of property. She's coming into herself. And then the other part is testing her ideas of what freedom can be. She really has no idea when she actually runs away. And so part of what I'm trying to do is show her different aspects of what the world could be and leave it up to her to sort of figure out where she fits in.
And it's quite clear in the story that freedom is not an automatically idyllic state, that is there when you touch it.
And the North is free and also very racist. So it's one thing to get off the plantation. Do you actually escape the inherent discrimination set into to American society? And the answer is no.
You make the point very forcefully there that this was a series of tests, because after all, people on the real Underground Railway being passed on to avoid danger from one sympathetic family to another, had to realise or had to accept that they were trying to reach a world across the River Jordan, so to speak, of which they knew very, very little in those days.
It's Boston, it's New York, and they have some vague idea of what it might be to be free, but
different kind of life completely.
Yeah. And their journey does go in stages with one family in their cellar for a month, in the hold of a ship to cross a river, and then you hand off to somebody else. And at each juncture, you could be captured and put to death. The people could be jailed or put to death. And so baked into the story is this real life or death stakes.
Well, in the book, we read about, for example, the runaway slave adverts, and we know that the plantation owners would do a great deal to get people back and punish them as examples.
Yeah, I put some real runaway slave ads in the book. They're 200 years old. No one's going to sue me. Copyright laws being what they are. And I could have written my own, but I couldn't really compete with the nature. They're so concise. They lay out the power dynamics. Millie ran away for no reason. Of course, there's a reason. Has a burn on her arm from an injury. How'd she get that injury? Last seen in the vicinity of the colored community in Edmonton. Well, what's that community like? I stuck him in there, and there was a newspaper guy whose job it was to write these things. And in doing the research, I started to see how vast the enterprise was. It's not just slave masters who are involved. It's the newspapers. It's blacksmiths who make the nails that go into the wheels that take the cotton to market. And it really did encompass so many different people in America.
Can I just say, I think your book probably has been one of the most powerful books I've ever read. But aside from that, I'd like to explore the character Ridgway. In your book, you clearly say that Ridgway's father was a blacksmith who enjoyed his work. He had a spiritual view of the world. And he had a friend who was mixed race. And they would discuss those aspects of the world of an evening. So how did this young boy at the age of 14, this young Ridgway, what motivated him to become a patroller, to join a group that was violent, that was criminal, and that was deeply racist?
Well, I think it was, you know, I think in him all along, and then I think he comes into himself as he becomes a slave patroller and then a slave catcher. A slave catcher is someone who's retrieving runaway slaves. He was a hard person to figure out when I was writing. I knew I wanted him to embody certain philosophies of white supremacy, imperialism, manifest destiny, and finding his voice was pretty difficult. But then I did some research and came across some material about the competition between slave catchers and abolitionist lawyers in New York. They're in this constant battle of outwitting each other. And it seemed like so many people, he comes to New York, the big city, to find himself. And that's where he comes into his own. There are perfectly liberal parents who have children who become terrible racists. There are incredibly racist parents who have children become liberals. So unfortunately, your home training doesn't always translate into good behavior later.
And of course, in the Deep South in those days, there was such a settled view of the world that it was difficult for people to challenge it, or at least it required courage and free thinking to challenge it. For example, they would be told in church how slavery was part of the natural order of things.
You know, it's the central assumptions of your society that you grew up with. Black folks are inferior, white people are superior, black folks should have no rights. And so he definitely doesn't question those propositions, and indeed his job is to support them and prop them up.
You're listening to Book Club on BBC Radio 4. Colson Whitehead is talking about his novel, The Underground Railroad.
Hi, Colson. It's a hugely enjoyable book. Why? Well, I suppose what I mean is, as I think about it, it's everything is so bleak. The events and the background, the context. I mean, that's not fiction either. That's real. Did you have to work hard to make it the enjoyable read that it is?
Well, I mean, hopefully you do something for 20 years, you get better at it. So hopefully, you know, it's my eighth book, and I've gotten better at getting folks down the page or telling a story. There was that life or death element, and so there are higher stakes. I think Cora is a very strong character.
That question of enjoyment raises the question of hope, I think. And one of the things that saves the book from an appalling bleakness with no relief in sight is that there are little glimmers of hope. They don't materialise as much for most of the people, certainly not those left behind who are in the book, but there is something there that people can cling on to, isn't there?
If you don't have hope, you don't leave. This book and my previous novel before this one was Zone One. It was a zombie apocalypse, also very bleak, everyone's dead. But the hero has to believe that there's a safe human settlement somewhere, you know, a place in Maine where the zombies haven't found yet. And so there's an animating hope that keeps him alive and an animating hope for Cora. And if you don't have that spark, that belief, that faith, despite all the contrary evidence, there's no story and there's no real living.
Nothing keeps you going. You don't want to turn the page.
Yeah.
How are you able to make the sense of dread and the claustrophobia and even the violence feel so vivid when it wasn't very graphic or very, it's fairly sparse language considering how it was hard to take sometimes?
Sure. You know, in terms of the violence in the book, most of it is, I think, blunt and matter of fact. And I got that from reading slave narratives. Former slaves in their memoirs will describe the most horrible things in a plantation. And they don't have to adorn it. They don't have to sell it to the reader because it speaks for itself. And so I certainly didn't need to go into a 5-page description of someone being tortured on the plantation. I'd rather talk about Cora and who she is. And so the matter-of-fact treatment of violence came from real-life memoirs, and I think serves the book.
How much did it take for you to really write that book and, like, kind of have that strength writing it, knowing that you might have responses from, how do I say, white fragility, for example? Like, how did you cope with it as a writer?
Yeah, I don't think about the audience. I just try not to screw it up page by page. I can't be responsible for other people's responses. I can just tell the story the way I want to do it, and hopefully if I do it right, people will come along. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. I would say that.
Lady here.
This is such a literary book. You've already mentioned Harriet Jacobs and The Odyssey and Gulliver's Travels. And there are just so many books that are evoked despite the extraordinary originality. Like, towards the end, we circle back to the Randall Plantation, and there's this chapter about Caesar, and he's reading Gulliver's Travels. And I was wondering why you picked that moment in the text and that book for Caesar to be reading.
Sure. We mentioned Ajari, the grandmother, and she opens the book. And so in 8 pages, we get a very compressed history of a slave's life, from being kidnapped in Africa, Middle Passage, various plantations. And originally, I didn't have these, what I call the biographical chapters of Caesar, of Mabel, and stuff like that.
He's the one she escapes with.
Yes, Caesar. But I really just wanted to set the stage with Ajari, and then I could get on to the Cora story. But it worked so well, it seemed those biographical chapters could open up the book to different parts of the world that Cora can't see. And so they became a motif in the book. And then I had to pick where, strategically, these different stories should go. Mabel's story, the mother, has one effect on the reader after Georgia. It has one effect on the reader in the middle and one effect on the reader in the end. And so as a storyteller, I'm trying to figure out where's the most strategic place to deploy these different sections. Gulliver's Travels, you know, for 14 years, I had the idea in the back of my head. And I would tell people, and they would say, that sounds really stupid. And then I realized when I started saying, like Gulliver's Travels, they're like, oh, I get it now. And so I'm not like a big Gulliver's Travels fan. I did reread it before I started writing the book. And I was like, this has a lot of specific stuff about British history. I have no idea what it is. Mm-hmm. However, the structure is very sturdy. And so I wanted to shout out more distinctly to Gulliver's Travels. And then with Caesar, I don't want to go too deep into why that chapter is there. I think it has a dramatic placement there.
We meet various people in the story who help Cora, including Martin and Ethel Wells. I felt a lot of sympathy for Martin because his father's dying wish was for him to carry on his father's unfinished work as a station agent. But as much as I tried, I couldn't feel any sympathy for his wife Ethel due to her deep-rooted opinions about slaves. Was I being too harsh on her?
Oh, I love Ethel. She's terrible. She's a terrible person. So she's fun to write. And so I remember those different days in August 2015 when I was like getting Ethel on the page. Because the book keeps rebooting, there's a very big cast. And it's not just people who were for or against slavery. A lot of people just don't think about slavery at all. In the same way, you know, some folks across town aren't necessarily up all night thinking about Syria or incarceration camps on the southern border of America. People have their own troubles, not necessarily thinking about a lot of political issues. So Ethel, one, is, I think, a representative American, not too invested in the slave question either way, just going about her own business, has received racist ideas and doesn't question them. And then also, you know, with the side chapters, we mentioned Caesar's and Mabel's and now Ethel's, she represents a different kind of oppression in 19th century America, the oppression of women. She had ideas for herself and what she wanted to be, and the same way that Native Americans and black folks are excluded from all men are created equal, so are women. So Ethel becomes an opportunity to show a different side of what's going on in 19th century America outside of Cora's POV.
Hi, Colson. I'd like to come back to the utopia you mentioned where Cora thinks she's arrived at John Valentine's farm, where people are free, where black people are respected as are white people. My heart racing through the harrowingness of her previous escapades. I think Cora's finally arrived and I'm thinking, my heart rate slowing. Is this the end? Is this the, you know, the salvation? And there's more, and there's more atrocities. Why did you go on?
Well, I'm not going to let Cora off the hook that easily. You know, page 280, what kind of book is that? Ends there. The possibilities of Valentine Farm provide one idea of what's possible, the sort of black utopia. But can a black utopia exist in a racist country? They are self-sufficient, they have their own community, and they're also just down the road from the white town full of people who can be envious, people who resent black prosperity. And that happened a lot. I think the story of Valentine Farm played out in different places in America. A black town, a black community becomes too prosperous and then has to be destroyed. If there's mineral wealth, it's a great place on the river. They are getting too big for themselves. They have to be taken down a peg. And then maybe you can take over those mineral resources. So what happens there in that section is true to American history.
Colson, you mentioned that the book had a long gestation, that you carried it around with you for a long time. What finally inspired you to write it?
I had the idea in the spring of 2000, and I just didn't think I was a good enough writer to pull it off. I didn't think I was mature enough to deal with slavery. I thought if I was older, if I saw the world, had some Hemingway-esque adventures, I could bring that. And so I would finish a book and then pull out my notes and think, am I ready? And the answer was always no. Until about 5 years ago, I had sold a book to my editor, but I was having some doubts about it. So I decided to tell my wife about this Underground Railroad idea. As some of you know, sometimes in a marriage, you have to make conversation to kill the silences. And she just said, well, I don't want to say that the book you're working on now about a Brooklyn writer going through a midlife crisis is dumb per se, but this Underground Railroad book might have a little more meat on it. And so I sort of realized that the book I've been putting off is probably the one I should be writing, the book that, not to get too self-helpy, but if I have been so reticent to take it on, maybe that's the book I should be doing.
Let's have a last question.
Somewhat following on from the discussion of hope, I was wondering what you wanted to explore about love and justice in the book. There are times where they're named explicitly, but they seem to be really central themes, even when they're not. Self-love, motherly love, the inability to love. What does justice look like? Is it vengeful? Is it creative? Is it transcendent?
Yeah, in terms of justice, I think you can decide. In terms of love, I mean, I think part of the story is coming to personhood. So what is Cora's idea of love after being abandoned by her mother, after being sexually assaulted, after being dehumanized every day of her life on this plantation? And so page by page and adventure by adventure, she's discovering what love is, what it is to love someone else, to be loved, to allow that or reject it, to love other people or not love them, not be capable of it. So she's not the same person on page 290 that she is on page 14. And part of her journey is coming into selfhood. And that means figuring out the capacity or incapacity to love someone else. And justice, if you're listening long at home, terrible things are happening to all these people. Does justice exist? Do you find it in this world at all? Keep turning the pages, I guess.
Colson Whitehead, thank you very much for being our book club guest this month and taking us on a journey on the Underground Railroad. Such a tremendous book. And thank you, too, to all our readers here in Broadcasting House. Everyone, of course, is welcome to come to a book club recording like this. We've got some great writers coming up. Just go to our website for the latest details and then email us. We love to have listeners reading along with us, and I know many of you do. Next month, on the first Sunday in November, we're celebrating, believe it or not, our 21st birthday with Bridget Jones by Helen Fielding, reading, of course, her famous diary, first published in 1996. That programme will be part of the BBC Arts Year of Literature. It's a great choice. Bridget Jones has become such an icon in our modern fiction. And, of course, that wonderful homage to Pride and Prejudice, which we all love. It also still makes you laugh out loud. Do listen in. Next week at this time, meanwhile, Mariella Frostrup will be back with Open Book. But now, from all of us here on Book Club, until next month and the next book.